Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. And it's great to have Maggie McKellar here. I'll introduce her briefly. Maggie McKellar studied at the University of Sydney and at the University of British Columbia. She obtained her PhD in 2002 for a study of Australian and Canadian comparative history. She's published two books, The Core of My Heart, My Country and Strangers in a Foreign Land. She obtained the Peter Blazey Fellowship, which led to the current book, When It Rains, a Memoir. Maggie McKellar, or Dr. McKellar, was a former lecturer at the University of Sydney. She's now writing full-time. She's raising two children, and when time permits, she's addressing the Sydney Institute. So it's great to have her here tonight to talk on the topic, Saying the Unsayable, Reactions to Grief in Modern Australia. Maggie McKellar, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. This has all worked out very well because I live about 5 hours west of Sydney, out past Orange, but it was our 20-year reunion and Elizabeth and I went to school together. So this is my second speaking appearance. And after my first speaking engagement, which was the 20-year reunion, Elizabeth came up to me and said, "Don't do that speech at the Sydney Institute."
And I said, "Please."
No. Most definitely not. But I always enjoy coming to Sydney, and I was having a coffee with a friend yesterday, and this friend is an academic and has recently published a book on manners in Australia, which is absolutely fabulous. And when I told her of the topic of this evening's paper, she most rudely spluttered through her mouthful that I may as well stand here before you and say nothing, for that, in her opinion, was the typical Australian response to expressions of grief. And on the one hand, she was right, and on the other hand, she was wrong. She was right because we do have trouble talking about grief. As a society, we want public expressions of private grief to be neatly packaged within the rituals of funerals, memorial services, and appropriate lengths of time of remembrance, and this time should neither be too short nor too long. To generalise for a moment, we don't cope well with public displays of emotion. We would prefer the stoic to the hysterical. But my friend was also wrong, because in Australia, grief plays a different and perhaps absurdly significant role in shaping our cultural understandings of ourselves. For Australian history is a history dominated by grief. Unlike other New World nations whose foundation myths celebrate triumphant moments, Australian national myths are marked as moments of failure, sacrifice and death, such as the futile expedition of Burke and Wills, the swagman's suicide celebrated in Waltzing Matilda, and the senseless sacrifice at Gallipoli. Beyond these moments stretches a history of the earliest literary accounts of forced convict migration and the very real grief of unforced migration. Literary hero Henry Lawson died tragically and wrote with dark realism of drought and despair and death. And Dorothea McKellar's much-recited My Country is strung through with images of drought and fire, famine and flood. From painting to fiction to films, the image of the lost child is a powerful signifier of loss and disconnection with both land and place. So this paper begins with the premise that grief is an emotional experience and process that is both at once universal and culturally and historically specific. In the context of modernity, one increasingly common response to loss has been to write about it. What I want to briefly examine tonight is the affect of writing about grief for both the writer and the reader. More generally, I'm interested in understanding the benefits and limitations of reading and writing about grief, both on an individual level and on a national stage. Grief, like its component part love, is amenable to cliche, the sorrow that knows no words, the labour of loss. But if grief makes us speechless, yet demands all our energy, what solace can the written word provide? I first asked that question as a reader, then I asked it as a writer, and the question shifted somewhat. In writing about grief, could I produce literature that transcends the delineated limits of grief writing? Grief has been defined in a variety of ways. In general terms, I work with the Oxford English Dictionary definition of mental anguish or deep sorrow caused especially by bereavement or bitter regret or remorse. But it's also important to note that beginning with Freud's Mourning and Melancholia, and further advanced in the 1960s with the publication of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying, there are now a variety of contested clinical definitions, such as complicated grief, pathological grief, and normal grief. Grief has also been identified as a fundamental component of being human, while others have challenged the idea that grief is universal. Given its central place within the human experience, grief has been of interest to scholars working in a range of fields. These include psychology, which has increasingly tested hypotheses about the benefits of life writing to the grieving process, and anthropology, which has identified a plethora of grieving processes across many cultures and societies. The emergence of grief in these fields parallels the development in literary studies, which in recent times has taken up the challenge to identify a genre called grief writing. Similarly, history, over the last 15 years, has turned its attention to death and bereavement through wartime and more generally through the history of emotion. Historians have been especially interested in connections and disconnections between public and private mourning. Within the field of Australian history, war has been an obvious rich site through which to explore these questions. Indeed, one could argue that in Australian history, some of the most innovative and insightful work has been produced through this focus on the relationship between public and private grief. There is also a substantial body of work produced by scholars working within the wider field of the history of emotions. This is a field which draws on other disciplines, particularly psychology, to liberate the history of emotions from an essentialist framework. In previous work, I have considered themes of loss and grief, initially in scholarly writing, such as my first book, Core of My Heart, My Country, where I explored the relationship between a sense of self and a sense of place for women who lived on the frontiers of Australia and Canada. And in this work, I explore the ways nature provides a source of solace and a perspective, a theme that has continued to animate my thinking and writing. Strangers in a Foreign Land, my second book, which discussed the experiences of settlers in the Western District of Victoria, touched on these themes as it examined letters written by mothers to their children a world away in England, or the words of an Aboriginal man who begged to be allowed back to his homeland, and hardened settlers who sought a connection back to the old world by writing journals to send to their friends and relatives. But most recently, I have written an autobiographical narrative on coming to terms with grief in my own life. And when I first started this memoir, there were very few modern literary texts that had something profound to say on the process of grieving. Simone de Beauvoir's A Very Easy Death stood out, as did C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed, and more recently I had read Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking. And of course there were innumerable self-help books, but there seemed to be very few genuinely intellectual explorations of grief. And then in the last few years, the publishing pendulum seems to have swung the other way, and there would appear to be a queue of books about dying friends, Helen Garner, lovers, Virginia Lloyd, mothers, David Reif. The list seemed to go on. And some have argued that this publishing phenomenon is a simple result of the baby boomer generation reaching an age where grief, death and loss have become preoccupying themes. But I don't agree. And just listen to the words written by the ancient Greek poetess Sappho. I simply want to be dead. No grove, no dance, no sound. Sappho shows us that writing about grief, death and loss has been around as long as words have been written on pieces of parchment. She also shows us that silence as an expression of grief is not a modern idea. Likewise, nothing has changed for the reason hungry for these stories. at last year's Sydney Writers Festival, it was the sessions on grief, death and dying which sold out fastest. But though it's tempting to see this as arising out of some new public preoccupation with grieving, it seems more obvious to say that these themes are universal to life. If these books are being placed in a session entitled Grief, this does not so much signal something new as a new platform to say something very old. Of course, I'm seduced by these books. I read them expecting to find a mirror for my own experience, and I was eager for someone to have done the hard thinking and made the connections between what they were feeling and a more universal experience of grieving. But so often what these books offer is little more than a recount, often beautifully told, of the pain of losing someone special. They chronicle the minutiae of watching someone die, and indeed they are often wise and reflective on the emotions, the physical experience of walking to the edge with a loved one. But what they haven't given me is anything beyond the descriptive. What I was looking for was a resonance between Sappho's poetry, the bare simplicity of her words, no grove, no dance, no sound, and my experience of loss, 1,000 worlds away. In the same way that Inga Clendenin wrote about illness, or Susan Sontag examined the metaphors we use to explain disease, I wanted to approach my own experience of grief and combine the intellectual with the intensely personal. So some context perhaps for you, a little chronology, a touch of clarification, so that this trajectory is laid out. I am pregnant. I'm giving you a trajectory of my past 8 years. I'm not pregnant at the moment. I hasten to add. Thank you. My husband gets sick, very quickly. He dies. 10 weeks later, I have my second boy, a second child, and he's a boy, and he's beautiful. I have a job as a lecturer in the history department at Sydney University. I publish my first book. I have my mother helps me bring up these two children. Life starts to look possible. She enables me to work by taking over much of the childcare. My son turns 2. My mother is diagnosed with cancer. 10 weeks later, she too is dead. I struggle on working full time. Without my mother, I can't keep going. I take some time off teaching, thinking this will give me a chance to regroup. And I return to the farm where my mother grew up, and where I was lucky enough to spend much of my childhood. At the end of my leave, I don't return to my job. I realise I've come home to stay. I've escaped the city and the pressure. I've rescued my children, but I haven't left behind the grief. And I'm just going to read you a short extract from a draft of When It Rains, which examines the interconnections between reading and writing about grief and my need for this to happen in a quieter landscape. After I made the decision to take a break from the university, I carefully chose the reading material I would take with me. Instead of the latest in post-colonial theory, I packed pyramids of words written by those whom I hoped would be fellow travellers. I read outside my comfort zone, turning to the ancients to see if they had any greater sense of surety. Occasionally, I tripped over a sentence and would be forced to lie upon the ground. I know one thing, all is grief for you. This scene is the dramatic climax to Euripides' Heracles, written at the end of the Peloponnesian War, when Athens was defeated by its overblown ambitions, and I had come across it in a recent translation by Anne Carson. Amphitryon is speaking to his son Heracles. Heracles has just slain his wife and children in a fit of insanity. The scene is bloody and desolate, and Amphitryon's words seem to cut through the madness of Heracles' actions as he defines his son, not by the murders he has just committed, but by the grief he will forever carry. In her essays introducing the play, Carson asks why tragedy is so vital an art form. For her, the tragedy becomes a frame that can be put around our grief. Inside the safety of that frame, the violent expression of grief and rage can be played out without you, in Carson's words, or your kin having to die. Nobody, writes Carson, wants to go down into the pits of yourself all alone. Instead, we are drawn to stories in which actors sacrifice themselves and dive into our collective darkness. Her words strike a chord. But then a quiver runs through me and I'm forced to ask, what happens when the players inside that created frame are not actors? What happens when it is you caught between grief and rage? When it is you who must go down to the deepest pit to search for the way to ascend to the light once more? What does Euripides and his light say for you then? Walking in the evening light, through the heavy scent of grass broken by the heat of the day, the willy wagtail sings his lament, and the sound carries across the garden and down over the flat. I find I can ask these questions of myself from the safety of this solitude. Though I find comfort in Euripides' plays, though they signal all I'm grappling with is not unique, they do not show me the path back to myself. The longer I remain trapped in Carson's frame, the closer I come to erasing myself and, like Heracles, become defined by grief itself. So for me, it is the act of writing that unlocks the frame. I pin my tragedy onto the paper and, with the precision of an anatomist, take a scalpel to separate memory from bone. Perhaps, if I can peel the layers of skin from its torso, it will stop having the power of a dark shape in the night. By writing, I risk sacrificing my deepest intimacies, but by writing, I can control the shape they become. I'm washing my mother in the shower. She's so weak. She gropes for the wall and shakes with the effort to stand and let the water stream over her. It's soon after her diagnosis, and we haven't yet gathered the paraphernalia of the seriously ill to help us through these daily tasks. In fact, her illness is so fast that by the time they arrive, the shower chair, the commode, walking frame, the all-white utility anonymously attesting to our entrance into the world of the very sick, my mother is too ill to be at home. But that day I walked into her bedroom and searched for her. She looked tiny, unrecognisable from the woman I had left only 3 days before. Then she was happily settling into her new house, alive to the possibilities of the future. We'd sat in the courtyard and talked of the garden she would put in. We'd eaten Thai food and drunk wine. She talked about the colour of the kitchen cupboards. She talked about the splashback she would choose for behind the sink. She talked as if there was going to be a tomorrow. The next time I saw her, I watched her as she slept, and I knew she was going to die. She seemed to age even as I helped her to the shower and as I washed her back. I didn't want to. I didn't want to love her in this way. I wasn't ready to help her as she died. The warm water sluiced over her skin and washed me too. I was shaken by the exchange between our bodies. In the cold feel of my mother's flesh, I met myself, as if death already stood beside us both. I write these words and feel small, incredibly selfish, unable to be the person I'd always imagined myself capable of being. That moment in my mother's bedroom defied the march of seconds and minutes and hours and days and years. Do you see that I met myself and was afraid? I was afraid my daughter would one day meet herself in me and that there was no point in living, for time had already ordained my end. I stood and washed and wept for her and for me and for she who follows. How do we all learn to accept that we are flesh and blood and must die? How do we grow wise enough to realise that nature doesn't distinguish between the deserving and the undeserving? How do we grow brave to face our own death? It's an ingrained habit to reach for words when I circle these unanswerable questions. I write as the memories rise up, and then I ask myself, why commit them to paper? Do I write to seek the trace of life, to find the entrance the moment it became something else? I seek words as I seek reality, in small bursts. Perhaps if I can shape the past, capture it for a moment, it will take a form I recognise. And now that I'm on the other side of that writing process, I've found myself somewhat fascinated with the manifestations of grieving in public life and what is allowed and what is suppressed. As a nation, we have an extraordinary number of public sites of mourning. The many articulations of a national shared grief surrounding Anzac Day began with the publication of Charles Bean's History of This almost from its conception and have moved through representations in popular cultures, in popular culture, in marches, memorials and pilgrimages. The complexity of these expressions raise the question, how do we distinguish between an expression of grief and an expression of nationalism? or a celebration of nationalism. In contrast, there are far fewer celebrated moments of Indigenous articulations of grief. Sorry Day is one attempt to find new public rituals to come to terms with this grief, but these two examples of public grieving serve very briefly to raise the question, how do we negotiate these public sites of grieving without them being hijacked as political pawns? For public grieving is important. I have partially framed my talk around cultures of grief to open a conversation on what public mourning is really about. And in a roundabout way, it brings me to the public-private paradox that exists in writing about grief. So many people have responded to my book. Many people have asked me how I could publish something so personal. Yet I don't think of what I've written as personal. Or perhaps, more accurately, I didn't think of it as such when I was writing. And this may sound odd, given the subject matter. And I very much did have to examine the reasons behind publishing. So yes, I wrote for me, and I wrote to order what had happened to me. But it was a very separate thing then to edit and read and rewrite and edit and read more and think more. And that process was not about me, but it was about an audience. And what I aimed for in that writing process was a universal expression of what happens when we suffer loss, experience grief, or try and reclaim our lives from the innumerable large and small tragedies that afflict all of us. But if in that process I allowed myself to think of an audience, if I thought of how the I that I created upon the page would be perceived, then I would stop. My brother, who is a musician, talks to me of that moment of connection between the artist and an audience, when the listener of music, the viewer of photography, or the reader of books recognises themselves in the expression of art. And while I was writing, I thought about this exchange. Though this moment feels unmediated, authentic, natural even, I'm talking about this moment of reading, connection between the reader and the writer, it's most definitely none of those things. It is an exchange, and this was what I strive towards when I thought about writing for an audience. And since the book has come out, I've been inundated most beautifully with letters and emails and messages from people who have read and been touched by my story, or perhaps more accurately, by the way my story resonates with their own. They write and say thank you for bearing my soul, and that's an expression they use over and over. And I guess on the one hand I have, but here's the contradiction. Because what I thought I was revealing was not me, but every grieving mother or wife or daughter or son or husband or father. As a society, we need to grieve collectively, but what is harder to acknowledge is that public expressions of grief carry a cultural agenda. There is a smaller space available to mourn someone who dies from a mental illness, like my husband, than the more public outpourings of collective loss when we mourn someone who dies from a heart attack or cancer. A lack of language to talk about these differences only solidifies these silences. What talking about grief in public has confirmed for me is that grief is at once specific and universal. People have wanted to thank me for speaking about grief, but they also want to share with me their specific story. And when I was first grief-stricken, I did experience the sensation of having no words to say how I felt, of being separated from society, of knowing people didn't know what to say to me. That is, my experience at that moment was unspeakable. And now I have shaped my experience into words, and this in turn has opened up a conversation, a space in the silence for others to speak of their grief. And that, I hope, is a good thing.
Many thanks for that. We've got Channel 648 on Fox Alanostar here today, so if you're asking questions, there's no need to stand up because you'll get in the way of the camera. But I may have to repeat a couple of the questions just so everyone listening at home can, or watching at home, can hear them. Before I start question time, I should say that Janet Grundy has provided some copies of Maggie McCullough's When It Rains, a memoir, her third and already best-selling book. And we've got some copies outside, and I'm sure Dr. McCullough would be happy to sign them. And so we come to questions and discussion. We will finish no later then, but possibly a bit before 7 o'clock. At the end, you spoke about the You spoke about writing about grief and talking about grief very eloquently, but as you are aware, there is an older attitude, and one time a prevalent attitude, that the best thing to do with grief is to get over it. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't like talking about themselves or anything about themselves, including their grief.
Is that like move on, is it? How, like move on?
Yeah, that's... We always get a bit of help from our cameraman, our photographer, yeah. So how do you sort of, I mean, were you ever in the period where you didn't talk about these things, or are you always the kind of person who's happy to talk about yourself?
No, I'm the daughter serious. Of a politician, of course I'm happy to talk about myself.
Okay, if you say you're the daughter of a politician, you'd better tell everyone
you're the daughter of. No, I don't need to do that, but... I think I was alluding to what you were saying in that a particular, and it's a cultural thing. I think it's that people prefer, you know, they don't want to see a huge outpouring of emotion. That there is a stoic sort of attitude towards grief. And I've always tried to get on with my life, make sure that the routines happen for my kids. I think that's really important with kids, that you don't fall in a heap if it's at all possible, and that you keep them doing all those things like going to school and all those routines that are so important. But at the same time, grief, and I talk about it in the book, moves in a very circular way so that it takes you by surprise. And I think that's what's so disorientating about the experience, is that you can look like you've got it all together and then be sideswiped by a moment. So I think there is a balance between always having to talk about it and just getting on with it.
So we go there, we go there, we go down the back, and we've got plenty of time, Anne.
Forgotten her name.
Maggie, I'd say, well, when you're speaking, could you just speak to the back of the room? Yeah, okay? That's right.
I've forgotten her name already, and you mentioned her, and she's very popular in the 80s and 90s, Skubaros, and the stages of grief.
Yeah.
You didn't go back over all of that, but did you feel you, because denial is one of the stages.
That's right.
And the other thing I want to ask you about is your children, because the book is just so beautiful. They're not really the centre of anything. They're so important to the story, and the way in which the horses made such a difference. And how did the children go through those stages as well? Because not both of them, because one of them, I suppose, didn't really experience it. But the your daughter,
both
your mother and your father.
Yeah, my daughter was very. One of the reasons I felt that I had to leave the city was that my daughter was becoming more ethereal as I watched her, you know, and everything. She was so anxious about everything. And she was 5 when her father died, and 7 when her grandmother, who was very, very close to her, died. And she got to the stage where she, you know, she'd be terrified about going to sleep at night. And my mother had been so helpful in helping me allow her to grieve for her father without pathologizing her necessarily. She used to say, "Of course she's having trouble going to sleep. Of course she's scared you're going to die. That's all right. She's going to be all right. Do the basics. Make sure she's well fed. Make sure she's loved. Make sure she's. Let's find something she's good at. Pour, you know, those sort of structures." After my mother died, that all fell apart for her, and it fell apart for me as well. I had a very demanding job that relied on me sounding intelligent in front of a group of people, which I used to think, if I didn't have to stand up in front of people, I might be able to keep going. But taking my daughter back to the farm and doing the terribly brave thing of buying her a horse somehow transformed her. And I think that the physical is very important in moving through grief. She was very quiet. She was a very anxious child. She's now so grounded and so confident. And learning to conquer this horse enabled her to feel a sense of control over her own life, that she could ride this enormous animal. She could get from A to B. If she felt sad, she could ride to the end of the paddock, or she could go somewhere that was outside of me, that was outside of other grown-ups. And she had this relationship with an animal, and I found that absolutely crucial in moving her through her anxieties. And she is a different child today. She's just going so well. She's great.
Elizabeth.
So I understand you've been recently filmed for Australian Story.
Thank you.
I wanted to understand how, you know, what the differences were between writing about the book, we have a lot of control and it's all in pages, and talking about it to a camera, and just talk a bit about that.
When Australia Story approached me, I was terrified, and to be quite frank, if I had a big bank balance, then I would never have gone ahead and done it. But the opportunity to appear on such a wonderful program, such a highly regarded program, and the chance to sort of reach a bigger audience meant that I couldn't in all conscience say no. And you're right, Elizabeth, the difference between writing a book where every word that I say on that page is very controlled, it's deeply thought through, to speaking to a camera where you don't know what the questions are. The interview that I did started at 9:15 in the morning and finished at 4:15 in the afternoon with an hour off, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. But I hope that the medium of television, the way Australian Story does it, which is that it takes a lot of time, that it lets you... It's not in it for the sensationalism, and well, in terms of my story. They're wanting to speak to bigger issues of mental illness, of grief, of single parenthood, of country living, of raising kids on a farm. So there's all sorts of bigger issues that they're wanting to talk to. But at the same time, I felt very challenged to move from the medium of writing into a place where I had to respond without a script in front of me.
Yes.
Andrew asked my question. I suppose we can't really sort of conclude about the difference between how a child handles grief and how you help your child, and the difference with how an adult handles grief.
It's a question about the difference between how a child and an adult handles grief.
In some ways, I think that they're similar, except the child in some ways has less hang-ups than the adult. And so one of the disconcerting things I found with my children, my son who didn't and doesn't know what a father figure, you know, he's got lots of men in his life, but who are all wonderful father figures, but he, you know, so what I found difficult was how quickly the kids would ask questions. And then, you know, we'd be driving along and one of them would say, "How did Dad die again?" Or, "Can you tell me again about, you know, some incredibly traumatic thing?" And I'd be driving on going, "Oh my God, I don't know." And that you would talk, if I could gather myself and talk to them in a very direct way, not hiding anything, they wanted you to speak to them, and then they moved on. And I found it a great lesson, actually, because it was like, you know, they'd say, or they'd come up to me and say, "I just feel really sad that Dad didn't see this," or "I wish BB had seen this." And we'd talk for a few minutes about it. And it was as if you could, if I could acknowledge the moment, then it fed them enough for them to walk out of it and keep doing what they were doing. If I made a big deal of it, I think it, you know, I tried to just respond in the way they asked me to. My grief was so much more complicated. Because I know more of the story. And a lot of the book is about teasing out the different complexities about losing a husband through mental illness versus losing a mother through cancer. And because they happen very one on top of the other, I suddenly felt terribly confused about who I was grieving for. And that's one of the themes of the book.
Okay, so Michael, and then we'll go over. Yes, Michael?
You talk about the different spaces, and as a young man, late teenage years, I remember clearly one of our football pals died in quite a tragic car accident, and I remember his funeral very clearly. A couple of other friends had died through mental illness, but through suicide, the experiences of the grieving around those deaths were so different.
Yeah.
And the accidental death, it was a celebration, it was, you know...
Yeah.
They were just so different. And it wasn't that there weren't big grieving, you know, funerals and that for the others, but no one said anything.
Yes, and Another reason why I agreed to do Australian Story was because of the shame associated with a suicide. And I have used the term mental illness simply because my husband's death was more complicated than the simple tag suicide. He was suicidal. He had escaped from a secure psychiatric ward and had placed himself in a terribly dangerous situation, which he then tried to rescue himself from and failed. So the shortcut is to say suicide, but of course it's more complicated for other members of the family. I think that one of the most difficult things is for my children is to be able to stand up and not be ashamed of how their father died. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing Australian Story, because I want them to be able to hold the fact that their father loved them and the fact that he was depressed and ill and therefore suicidal. And that those two weights, two realities, that they both can exist. They can exist together. And if I can give my kids a sense of depression is like cancer and that they can claim that and not be ashamed, then I'll be pleased.
So, yes.
Thank you very much. Incredibly moving. Today I heard that a pupil of mine had died of cancer at the age of 54. Now, I'm dreading this funeral because there'll be so many of his age there that will really never have met death.
Yes.
Because it's so uncommon.
Yes.
And the other thing is, too, that there's no longer within the community generally a fervent belief in the afterlife. So it seems to me that those two things make death even more horrific to the observer and to the relatives.
So I think that's a very interesting comment. I do think that we are unprepared for death. And one of the wonderful things about taking my kids to the country is that it moved them into a situation where they were constantly exposed to life and death. And, you know, we live on a sheep stud, so there's lambs being born all the time and lambs dying all the time and favourite dogs die of snake bites and chickens get taken by foxes, and yet you also get to hold new life. And I think that we as a society have moved a long way from nursing people in our own nursing elderly generations in our own homes, and so death is a shock. Everything is removed, you know. It's only in those moments that so few people have been beside the bed of someone that died. I think it's a very, very accurate comment.
Well, hang on, we go first to Stuart, yes?
Did you use, when your husband and your mother had passed away, did you use any services to
did I use any services?
To help you, or did you just use the writing?
The question is, did you use any counselling, or did you just write your way out of it?
Yes.
No, I didn't, and perhaps I should have. I had a tiny baby, and then I had a toddler and an older child. And I don't know, I think for me, in many ways, going back to the farm was the therapy. It was being able to take my state of mind out into the landscape and allow the landscape just to be there with no pressure. I realise that's a terribly privileged experience to have been able to do, and that not everybody is fortunate enough to be able to remove themselves in the way that I did. But I think if I say that I didn't have any formal counselling, I most certainly did have a sense of taking a moment outside of the normal continuity of what I thought my life was going to be like. So I don't know if that... And I had all those books too.
The question is how we as a society cope with not being trained to be carers?
Yes, I think there was another part of that question which was also to do with how medical science is keeping us alive a lot longer.
Yes.
And that, yes, I think that we are unprepared for death. It's like when you go into having a child, there's a very... You expect to come out alive the other side. We expect to be able to survive cancer. We expect to be able to survive heart attacks. And yes, I do think that death is a shock in all of those situations. For me, I actually found it easier to place cancer into my worldview, into my own worldview, than I had with mental illness, because which just shows how strong this gentleman's point is about the two different ways we mourn tragic accident or suicide. And when my mother was diagnosed with cancer, I just thought, well, you know, that's just life, isn't it? You just get it. And I also think that we are removed from nursing in our own home. And it would have been a wonderful thing to have nursed her, but it was impossible. And so that goes back to my point earlier that we're removed from death in a way that we weren't 50 years ago.
Right down the back, yes.
My students talk about being almost overwhelmed by Australian national grieving and their Sick of Anzac Day, the Sorry Day, the forced feather all the way through secondary school. They also talk about the silences on the other end of that grieving, that there's many things that aren't talked about. Bring those two priorities, if you like.
Maybe you could briefly repeat that.
The question is that many university students come to first year history and are sick of the public outpourings of grief through Anzac Day celebrations or through Sorry Day, and they don't have any resonance with them, and whether my book somehow falls in between. Would that be right? Is that...
Yeah. Yep.
And so I think... having taught first-year Australian history students, it's not an uncommon... but there's also something else happening there, and that is that many of them also embrace fervently the articulations of grief or the ceremonies of grief on Anzac Day because of an absence of ceremony in their own life. I think what my book does is perhaps cut through in providing a personal story and hopefully speaking to those larger themes. It'd be interesting to see. I hope it will be placed on university reading lists in years to come, and it will be interesting to see how it's read in that way.
So what courses would it be placed on?
Australian literature, life writing, memoir, I don't know.
Sure, I'm just wondering, there's a new book come out by Grace Carstens, which takes slightly more of an antidote approach, that they really weren't as badly treated as the early people.
Yeah.
And they're a lot heavier than it's been suggested. They weren't breathing all the time.
Yeah.
So that might sort of cast another light on the situation as well nationally. I'm not talking about...
Yeah. Yeah, Grace's book is a wonderful book. Right. It's a really... it's just won the Prime Minister.
This is Grace Carstens' book. Just repeat that a bit.
Oh, just that Grace Carstens' book is looking at the early settlement of Sydney.
And this is happiness, right?
Yeah, and seeing the agency that convicts particularly had within... that they wouldn't have had unless... I agree that her book is fabulous. The way she uses sources it breaks open this early period of our history. And yes, I hope that it changes the way we teach this era.
Can I ask you?
Yes, sir.
How much of the student boredom of some of this might be that we've mistaken alienation for grief? Because a lot of our national grieving there's an element of alienation in it. That we are guilty, that we are rejecting the community that we are and trying to say we've made lots of mistakes. I mean, it must come a point, and your book's also about healing, and some of our national grieving hasn't gone the next step.
No, I don't think it has at all.
And I think that's probably like the fate of Shore. It's all full of guilt and hideous sort of mortification and all the rest of it, which really becomes alienation.
Mm.
But tell us a bit more about the healing.
Well, I think our suggestion is we all should buy a horse. Is it?
Well, no, no, right. You know, I would have loved to have ridden a horse.
If I had published this book 5 years ago, it would have been a very different book. It would have been a far angrier book. And the anger still sits in the book. It's still... I haven't removed that. But time is a cliche, and it's also a wonderful thing, because I've been asked to speak at a number of different conferences and events, and some of them are... the requests have been unusual. For instance, Lifeline have asked me to come to their national conference to speak next week. And I was... at first taken aback by the suggestion that I would be a motivational speaker, having never seen myself in that role. But what the national director said to me was that so seldom do they have a story that offers redemption, and so often they're volunteers, and from volunteers all the way through the organisation, they're dealing with people at the sort of the... coalface of grief and loss and illness, that it's actually refreshing to know that there is life on the other side of it. And so this book has traced my journey out of grief, and I think offers anybody who has that experience both the chance to feel that their experience has been articulated, and also perhaps the hope that they will come through the other side of it as well.
Okay, so we're getting towards the end. Hang on, there's a couple of others. Yes?
Maggie, religion has been a great user of grief as a means of getting people to come to the faith.
Mm.
Do you think with the change that's taking place as far as the approach of people to religion, that there's a gap there, and what you're saying is, could be a way of means... overcoming that grief, that left a lot on its own today rather than religion just sweeping it all up and covering it.
Mm.
There's a suggestion that religion provided a structure. A structure for handling grief, yeah. And the decline of religion in Western societies had an impact on how grief is handled, yeah.
I think that the church, in all its forms, has definitely offered the structures within which people can grieve. There's, you know, the local parish is still operating, but no longer at the levels that it used to. And so, yes, I think that people find themselves very much adrift without any sense of being propped up, or that, you know, the marking of time through services is absent when they don't have those structures that the church provides. Gosh, I feel it would be presumptuous of me to say that, I think everyone has their own way of dealing with grief, and that I'm not necessarily saying that the way I've done it is any better or worse than anybody else.
But there is a different generation issue here, isn't there? Because when I was young, a long time ago, we went to a Catholic church on Sunday, and I mean, we were surrounded by death. There were crucifixes on the wall.
Yeah.
Our heroes were all martyrs. And to be a martyr, you had to die.
How did you end up at that?
Rejection.
And I remember, I mean, every Sunday, the priest got up and before the sermon and picked up the black book and read out the names of the parish who had died, and we all said a prayer for the deceased, and at the end, just to sharpen things up, we prayed for the conversion of the Soviet Union, which was actually quite a good idea. Quite a good idea. But we did sort of come up. I mean, I spent most of my young life living with death. It didn't surprise me much at all.
Shows.
But it's different now.
Much interjection from the side here.
Well,
it wasn't like that in the Protestant church as well.
Perhaps the Reformation's
at fault. Yes. Yeah.
I agree that it's a generational shift that we're experiencing, and perhaps that it has created a gap that we don't yet know how to fill.
Yeah.
What do you make of the public output of guilt? Michael Jackson, we don't talk about our own grief,
but I've seen the rest.
Yeah.
There's a question about the public outpouring of grief for celebrities like Princess Diana and Michael Jackson.
I think actually the last question is connected with your observation of this public outpouring, that we don't have the same sort of traditions to understand death on an individual level. And I think there's a couple of things. I don't really understand this. There's been a lot of study done on this. But people love to, they are drawn to, you know, they want to go to rock concerts, they want to be part of big, they want to feel a part of something. And grieving about a single figure together, I think, gives them a sense of connection, that they put their own sorrow into that moment. So that in grieving for Princess Di, so many people were, it was about themselves, I think, and as much as it was about her. And we don't have those. I don't think we have any. The other day, my daughter, who is 13 now, came home from school and told me that very tragically another 13-year-old in the district had been killed in a car accident, and that this is a child that her friends and her Aki also knew, but not well, just a child that they might see at a swimming carnival. They weren't great friends, and she was really upset because of the hysterical response. And 13-year-old girls, you know, they do tend towards the emotional side of the spectrum. But she said, Mum, I started feeling upset. I started crying because everyone else was crying, and then I felt guilty for crying because I wasn't really sad about this little girl because I didn't know her. And yet, apparently, you know, the whole year was just sort of wandering around weeping. And I think that's really unhealthy, because it's encouraging these kids to have these over-the-top responses to something that they have no concept of. And I thought my daughter's reaction was interesting, because grief is something that she actually understood. So she felt guilty for A, crying about something that wasn't necessarily resonating with her, and B, that she was also confused because she didn't understand why everyone else was crying. And I think that it has something to do with these huge Michael Jackson, Princess Di type moments on a much smaller level, of course.
Final question. You said up front that you'd given up your job as an academic, and you were writing. So of your sort of second professional career, this is your first offering. What else are you writing?
I am about to be terribly brave and embark on a work of fiction, and it will be historical fiction. And I'm not signed up yet, so I can't say anything more.
you might get an offer. Okay, that's fine. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Well, many thanks to Maggie McKellar. As I said, copies of When It Rains, a memoir, Janet Grundy's, provided outside. Look, it's been a terrific night tonight. Very moving and very informative. I didn't know our speaker's husband, but I did know her mother. I thought was a wonderful woman. I didn't know her that well, but what I knew of her, I thought she was terrific. And her death was very sad. But I think you've done remarkably well tonight and been outspoken and direct, which is always the best way to communicate, and honest and insightful. And I'm sure your career as a writer has already been successful, but I'm certain will become even more successful, in which case we'll see you back here in the future. But for tonight, well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.